illegal colonial settlers were then wearied of all the liberation movements and factions in the region besides the already existing Palestinian resistance. The Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said in his last speech on the occasion of the 17th anniversary of the victory of July 2006 that the victory of July 2006 put the Israeli enemy along with its entity on the line of descent and the line of decline. What Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said about the July victory and its relationship to the Israeli line of decline leads us to shed light on the beginning of this line since the withdrawal from Lebanon in the year 2000, which lies between two promises, the Balfour Declaration and the promise of the hereafter. The victory of 2000 opened the path to the Israeli decline that established all the victories of the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine. In the same year, the second Palestinian intifada known as the Al-Aqsa Intifada began, one of the most important results of which was the dismantling of the Israeli settlement project in the Gaza Strip and the withdrawal of the Israeli army from it in 2005 due to the continuous strikes of the Palestinian resistance. The pivot point in the line of Israeli decline was the July 2006 war, known to the Zionist entity as the Second Lebanon War and recognized by it as a clear military defeat. After that, the Palestinian resistance wars began since 2008 until the last battle dubbed Revenge of the Free, passing through the Sword of Al-Quds and others, which came in the context of the Israeli decline. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. The free peoples of the world, along with the supporters of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, commemorated the 17th anniversary of the victory of the Mujahideen of Hezbollah over the Israeli entity in the aggression that the latter began on July 12, 2006, which ended forcibly with humiliation of the entity on August 14. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament in the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc Hezbollah. A pleasure to have you along with us on this special day, Dr. Moussaoui. Now, the Lebanese prepare every year on August 14 to revive the occasion of the victory against the Zionist entity in 2006, which has become a defining point in their history as a people, in the history of the resistance, in the history of the peoples of the region, and in the history also of the Israeli entity and its settlers. How do you recall August 14, 2006?
Well, thank you for giving the opportunity. And yes, this is a very important time and occasion that we should always commemorate, we should always remember. And if you ask any Lebanese, not only any Lebanese, any free human spirit, any free human soul, any Arab, any Muslim, any revolutionary, any someone who seeks freedom and dignity, he will tell you definitely, or they'll tell you definitely, this is a period of dignity, of glory, of freedom, of independence. People long all of their life to find a meaning for their life, actually, because, I mean, life without a meaning is lifeless. So when the resistance emerged victorious after this very important battle against the Israeli occupation, against the Israeli colonization, against the world imperialism, because when we talk about Israel here, we're not talking about an isolated phenomena, we're not talking about an isolated state, we're talking about a state that all of the support from the Western hegemonic world pour into it in order to supply it with all high-tech weaponries, with all, if you want, political immunity, because the veto is always there at the Security Council to torpedo any attempt to condemn Israel, let alone to put sanctions or whatever. So when we commemorate this time, when we commemorate this occasion, it gives us a pride, it gives us dignity, it gives us also the will and the determination and the resolve to continue our struggle against the occupiers, against the expansionists, against the imperialists, and against this inhumane Western system.
Well, Dr. Moussaoui, the victory of July 2006 is a historical turning point between the beginning and the end of the so-called Israel. It's a central station that separated the stages of Israeli rise and the Israeli decline, and an essential history between two promises, the false Balfour Declaration or promise and the true promise of the hereafter, which you are just explaining right now, and the decline of the actual entity. Does the Israeli entity's leaders know that they are on a path of decline?
If you go to their statements, if you go to the testimonies of so many Israeli leaders, so many Israeli historians, so many Israeli officials who have been in office, like whether they are generals in the army or they are in the intelligence with the Mossad and whatever, they all talk about this. And whether they are clerics, religious leaders, rabbis and whatever, there is a kind of a convergence, and many testimonies could be brought up very simply about their, if you want, a prophecy about the demise of Israel. They all talk about the 80 years. It hasn't, no Israeli, no Jewish state has long or has survived more than 80 years, and now they are itching very closely to the 80 years. I mean, more importantly, when you see on the other side, when you see the Lebanese, when you see the Syrians, when you see the Palestinians, and basically, and most importantly, the Palestinians, who were the first victims of the Israeli occupation, of the world conspiracy, of Balfour Promise, of the British Empire, of the American Empire now, of the Western support. You're talking about people who are isolated, who are only supplied with arms from few and very few number of states. You're talking about Lebanon, you're talking about Syria, you're talking about Iran, and the whole world is behind the Israelis, supporting them and supplying them. If you go to the other side, I said, you asked about the Israeli side and what they say. Now come and see what's happening on the ground. The Palestinians, the Palestinian generations, the youngsters, they are fighting Israel as if Palestine was occupied just yesterday. Generation after generation, they hold this torch of liberation, of resistance against the Israelis. And this is very telling. This is very promising. We hold tightly to our cause with a few supporters around, and they are, if you want, fed up with all of this world support to them and with this so-called state and entity that they hold to. They cannot continue. They are talking about their demise. They are talking about...
But Professor Moussaoui, I thought about this very hard, and I thought that reaching the promise of the hereafter, wa'adul akhira, as we know it, it needs a liberation project that puts the wheels of resistance action on the track of the train of the divine destiny, traveling towards the station of the promise of the hereafter without dependence that hinders action, or maybe recklessness that frustrates action. And it needs awareness with insight that makes that takes human action, not only just thoughts. The waiting hall on the sidewalk, the sideline of history, and protects it from jumping into the void of history like multiple liberation movements throughout the 20th and 21st century. How is Hezbollah preparing for this phase?
Actually, it's not Hezbollah who is preparing. When I was talking about the generation after generation, the most important thing is the will, is the intention, is the determination, is the resolve. And it's there. When it is there, there is a will. When there is a will, there is a way. And the will is there, and the way is there as well. The path is there. If you talk about the people of the world, now you know, and many people are aware that even inside the America, I mean, if you talk about the people, people are being brainwashed. People are being misled. They don't know about the reality. They only hear the mainstream media in America, which presents Israel as the oasis of democracy in the region. It was a desert and they turned it into a paradise. This is what they hear most of the time. But those who are aware of what's really happening, they know very well that their government is twisting the facts and is bringing fallacies into their minds and into their awareness. The awareness around the world, even there has been a statistic recently, a poll among the Democrats themselves who are now presiding, they say there is more inclination to the Palestinian right than what the Israelis have been doing. You're talking about 80 years of black, gray, whatever propaganda by the Israelis and the most important media outlets all over the world. It was not able to brainwash or to twist the will of the Palestinians. They are there, the generations are there, the faith, the deep conviction of liberation of Palestine is there. Hezbollah is one part, one group, a very leading, prominent, protagonist group against the Israelis. The Palestinians are there, the Arabs are there, and many of the free people in the world, they support the Palestinians. That's why I believe we are in the true path. Everything is prepared. We are only talking about a matter of time before the liberation takes place. Yes, it has, and it needs preparation. Yes, it needs planning. Yes, it needs training. Yes, it needs arms. And here you see the Islamic Republic of Iran as the main stronghold for all of the liberation forces and groups and resistance forces and groups, and not only in Lebanon but also in Palestine, in Syria, in Yemen, everywhere, in Iraq. Here you have a stronghold that is supporting, that is giving all the supplies, and more importantly, you have this wise leadership represented by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. You have this leadership and charismatic leadership of this Sayyid Nasrallah. You're talking about the allegiance of the people, their loyalty, their devotion to the cause. I believe those are the essence of any liberation, and those are the essence of any plan for the future of liberation.
Well, perfectly said, Dr. Mousaoui. Let us now move on to the second segment, where we'll be talking about how the confrontation with the Zionist entity will look like in the future.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Military echelons inside the Zionist Israeli entity do not hide their permanent intentions to launch a war against Lebanon, especially after the results they drew from the July 2006 war and the defeat they suffered in terms of not achieving the goals of the war after 33 days of fighting and being forced to accept a ceasefire without revealing the fate of its two soldiers, whose capture was the direct reason for the start of the aggression. How will the next confrontation look like in this following report?
Leaders of the Israeli entity have never hidden their permanent intentions to launch a war against the Republic of Lebanon, especially after the results they viewed of what they called the Second Lebanon War, known to us in the region as the July 2006 War. Zionists suffered a resounding defeat in 2006 in terms of not achieving the goals of the war after 33 days of fighting and then being forced to accept a ceasefire without ever revealing the fate of its two soldiers, who once were captured, the aggression began. On August 14, 2006, the war ended. Ehud Olmert stood in the Knesset to announce what he considered a victory, but the disapproving voices emanated from the members of the Knesset extended outside it, forcing occupation government to form the Vinograd Committee to investigate the readiness and performance of officials in the government and the security establishment in the war. The committee concluded months later that the war was a fiasco on the part of Olmert and his officials. Since that time, the military establishment has been preparing for the scenario of the next war with Hezbollah, evaluating the annual exercises and maneuvers and issuing reports that it acknowledges that it serves a main goal, which is, quote, the war in the north, unquote, and the scenario of confronting the elements of the resistance. The Israeli entity did not launch a war for 17 years. Its drums were beaten more than once, and it came close to erupting on many occasions. However, the reactions of the Lebanese resistance and its loud rhetoric were the cause of the Israeli entity's permanent retreat, on the basis that the preparation for war prevents its occurrence. The two sides, however, consider the war is inevitably coming, and what supports this is the statements of the two parties and their high readiness for it. On the anniversary of the liberation of southern Lebanon this year, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said, "Whoever assumes that the battle with the occupation has ended is delusional." He warned the Israeli occupation leaders who keep bringing up the Great War that this war will include all borders and its fields will be packed with hundreds of thousands of fighters. This was repeated more than once by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Hezbollah officials, albeit in different forms. The party's latest maneuver on May 21, 2023, the resistance's latest maneuver on May 21, 2023, indicated that it is focusing on offensive capabilities and training in preparation for the next war. The Israeli occupation, for their part, do not stop talking about preparing for a war against Hezbollah and warn that the army and the home front are not ready to wage this war, especially if it expands to include the rest of the resistance axis.
We are back from Beirut with Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament in the Loyalty to the Resistance bloc Hezbollah. Thanks again for being with us, Dr. Moussaoui. Now, in the first week of July, we all read what the Israeli military intelligence Amman said. It expected an all-out confrontation to break out on the northern front, that's the border between Lebanon and occupied Palestine, attributing the matter to the, quote, erosion of the home deterrence in the face of Hezbollah. How do you see this next confrontation?
Well, to tell you the truth, it's difficult to fathom the next scenario, what's going to happen, actually. But it's basically clear for us is that we have the upper hand and we are in a better position 10 times, 100 times than we were at any time in the past. More importantly, if you go back to the reports and to the testimonies against of the Israelis, whenever an operation used to take place, the glorious operations of the resistance, the Israelis used to say that Hezbollah is one step ahead of us. I can tell you now, I mean, out of information that are spreading everywhere, and it's becoming a common fact, that Hezbollah is 10 steps ahead of the Israelis. Had the Israelis been able to start a war before, every time the Israelis want to start a war, or they, if you want, threaten that they are going to bring Lebanon back to the Stone Age or whatever, a new revealing of the capabilities of the resistance come and puts the Israelis on their knees, actually, before any confrontation takes place. What I can tell you, we have the upper hand. The resistance in Lebanon has the initiative now. The Israelis are not in a position to be able to handle the brunt of any confrontation in the future. Hezbollah is being elevated into a kind of existential threat to the existence of Israel itself. And we're talking about one resistance group. So how come if you talk about a sector, a whole axis of resistance, when you talk about the Islamic resistance, about Hezbollah resistance that is being designated as an existential threat to Israel, to all of the entity of Israel, and its capability to spread out its rockets all over the Palestinian territories and all of the Israeli points and military options.
I had the pleasure and the opportunity, actually, to visit last Saturday parts of the Lebanese territories that witnessed heightened clashes between the Israeli entity and our glorious Hezbollah fighters.
I read what you put in the social media.
It's the least that I could do, but we met with leaders of the resistance and as well. Now, I'm not going to talk emotionally what that did to me, but we spoke about the capabilities and the developments of the resistance, the way you just explained, and the development of the resistance, the increase in its numbers, its equipment, and the experience of its fighters contributed very much to the postponing of the occurrence of the war and increased the Israeli fear of the consequences of this war. But in short, Israel now finds itself between a hammer and a hard place, between
exactly.
a rock and a hard place,
of
because
course.
It's two bitter choices, as the war today will cost it more than it can bear, and the continuation of the idea of just postponing the war makes its image ever so eroding.
Exactly.
Which of these options do you think the occupation will take?
Well, I'm sure, I don't know what to say. No, sure is not the point. I am confident that the Israelis are not in a position to start a war now. They are only trying as much as they can to elevate their image in the eyes of their people. And if you all recall this report by the Israelis, they themselves said that all the Israelis in the northern settlements and in the northern border of Palestine adjacent to the Lebanese borders are not in a position to be defended and they have to depend on themselves because they expect that the Hezbollah fighters would storm the northern part, the Galilee and whatever, and they can do nothing about it. So here it has always been that the Israelis can come to Lebanon. It's a kind of picnic and they would come in the morning because they can finish Lebanon in 2, 3, 4 hours. Now the thing has switched and has been twisted dramatically. They are afraid that the Lebanese resistance, Islamic resistance, Hezbollah fighters are going to storm and go there. And that's why they are building these fences and all of these walls around.
They don't know that we can fly if you want to. So, but there's this thing that they still have the upper hand in, which is the aerial force, the air force
true,
that they
true.
Have. But
to a certain extent.
Exactly.
Because
My question is, who said that the resistance would allow the occupation freedom of aerial movements
their hands are not free.
The way it was in 2006?
Their hands are not free as they used to be. This is one thing. And you remember, and we all remember, that the resistance, you did say something about your visit, about the capabilities, about the experience, about the armaments, whatever. But we all know that Hezbollah and the resistance has always been keeping, and they continue to keep surprises, military surprises or technicalities or kind of weapons that nobody would have imagined, as what happened in 2006 with the Sa'ar, with the warship that has been targeted by the rockets of Hezbollah, the air-to-water or land-to-water missiles that has been used. So nobody could predict what kind of armaments would appear in any future confrontation. This is for sure. And the other thing is that the Israelis are not prepared psychologically to take it anymore. That's why they only would make threats and would make warnings. And this is not going to find any reality, in fact, actually.
That's we spoke about that a lot, and we also spoke about the weaponry that Israel does not really know what the Islamic resistance has, especially the drones part, because we are now all attached to our screens, to our smartphones, watching what's happening in Ukraine between the Russian Federation and the NATO and U.S. forces in Ukraine, and how Russia is fighting with drones. This is, I mean, we're witnessing a new kind of war, and we asked about that, and the resistance was reluctant to tell us because they want to keep it a secret and a surprise for the Israeli entity. But bringing us here, just hanging on to everything that has happened and being proud of that victory, what do you tell the people of the world listening and watching us about this very moment in time when Israel is at its weakest?
Well, to tell you the truth, it's a theme that should be construed, should be understood, and should be held tight to our hearts and souls and spirits. What's really meaningful in this life is to have a meaning of life. I go back to the first thing that I mentioned. Life without without independence, life without freedom, life without dignity is not a life. Death is better than to die is better than to live under humiliation and without dignity and independence.
Indeed.
That's why
Minna Dilla is
exactly
more
exactly. That's why what I can simply say is that the Lebanese resistance has given a pattern, has given a symbol, has given a pattern to be emulated by all parties, by all people around the world, by all resistance forces against the occupation and against any enemy. When there is a will, there is a way. They say not only the Islamic resistance, the Palestinians. Now see what's happening in Jenin, see what's happening in the West Bank. We saw what happened in Gaza that was liberated. South Lebanon was liberated. See what's happening in Yemen, see what's happening in Afghanistan, see what's happening in Iraq. So see what's happening in Syria. So we're talking about things that have been, if you want, tested on ground, and it gives and it paid this kind of independence and dignity. So we can simply say this is a day to be celebrated by all free people of the world, all those who are under occupation, all those who are under hegemony, the American, the Israeli hegemony, the Western hegemony. They should know that there is always a way to resist against any kind of occupation, no matter how ruthless it is, no matter how savage it is. We could simply be able to do a lot in order to fight it back, in order to regain our dignity, regain our land, regain our freedom and independence.
Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, a mentor, an idol, and a dear friend, Lebanese member of the parliament and the loyalty to the resistance bloc, Hezbollah. Thank you immensely for being with us and contributing
Pleasure.
To our show despite your schedule, your packed schedule. Thank you for being here. Ladies and gents, thank you. Do celebrate with us August 14 because it is a memory to celebrate against the Israeli entity. See you again next week. Assalamu alaikum.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Economic Activity of Public Bodies Bill, which opposes boycotts of the Israeli regime, was introduced in the British Parliament, the House of Commons, recently, sparking a massive outcry. The legislation seeks to bar public organisations in Britain from boycotting the Israeli regime through sanctions and divestment campaigns. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. The website of Arab News has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's second largest trade union has declared its support for the pro-Palestine boycott, divestment and sanctions BDS movement against the Israeli regime, slamming the British government legislation barring institutions from boycotting products made in the occupied Palestinian territories. Unite, which represents 1.2 million British workers and is one of 15 trade unions affiliated to the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, passed three motions supporting the boycotts, divestments and sanctions regime at its conference on Friday, 14th of July, demanding that the British government abandon the Economic Activity and Public Bodies legislation that bans public bodies from launching their own boycott efforts, explicitly mentioning the Israeli regime and the occupied Palestinian territories. The relevant motion said the bill seeks to limit the ability of public bodies to make ethical choices about spending and investment that reflect widespread public support for human rights, climate goals and international law. The motion further pointed to Unite's support for boycotts, divestments and sanctions campaign against companies with ties to the Israeli regime and the occupied Palestinian territories. At the conference, the union also pledged to promote the right to boycott campaign among its membership, urging workers to sign a petition against the British government's bill. The PCS director, Ben Jamal, declared, "At the moment, when the government's anti-boycott bill seeks to delegitimize the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment and sanctions, the unanimous support of Unite's members for motions affirming support for boycott, divestment and sanctions is crucial. Unite has made clear that it will continue to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Palestinian people and reject all efforts to delegitimize their struggle for liberation." The Palestine Solidarity Campaign also pointed out that the bill would further shield companies engaged in human rights abuse or environmental destruction by preventing public bodies from cutting their financial ties with them over abusive or illegal actions. Another motion passed during the conference confirmed the union's recognition of the Israeli regime as practicing apartheid and demanded from the British government to abandon its free trade agreement with the occupying Israeli regime. The last motion passed in the conference concerned the Israeli military's labelling of 6 Palestinian civil society and human rights organisations as terrorist bodies, clarifying that the targeted organisations provide services and support to women, children, farmers and prisoners, and collectively support thousands of Palestinians. The conference emphasised this in a direct assault on an effort to isolate and restrict human rights defenders. Unite called on the British government to reiterate its support for the Palestinian civil society and for the Israeli regime to retract its spurious claims. The boycotts, divestments and sanctions movement, which is modelled after the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, was initiated in 2005. By over 170 Palestinian organisations that were pushing for various forms of boycott against the Israeli regime until it meets its obligations under international law. Thousands of volunteers worldwide have since then joined the boycotts, divestments and sanctions movement, which calls for people and groups across the world to cut their economic, cultural and economic ties to Tel Aviv to help promote the Palestinian cause. British newspaper The Telegraph has also covered the same story and tells us more. Britain's parliament is considering a government bill that would bar local councils from boycotting Israeli goods, drawing outrage from civil society organisations in Britain. The bill would prevent local councils and universities from adopting their own foreign policy by boycotting Israel or companies that trade with Tel Aviv. UK Community Secretary Michael Gove proposed the legislation to the British Parliament, the House of Commons, recently. Michael Gove told The Telegraph, "It is simply wrong that public bodies that have been wasting taxpayers' time and money pursuing their own foreign policy agenda." He added, "The United Kingdom must have a consistent approach to foreign policy set by the British government." Michael Gove accused anti-Israeli campaigns of undermining Britain's foreign policy. The legislation would enable ministers to conduct investigations into suspected breach of the ban. The Telegraph said public bodies that break the new rule could be significantly fined. Observers believe the legislation would be a direct assault on the Palestinian civil society movement, boycott, divestment and sanctions regime. Former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn said boycott, divestment and sanctions will be essential for ending apartheid by the Israeli regime, just as they helped end apartheid in South Africa. Jeremy Corbyn, who sits in the House of Commons as an independent, tweeted recently, "I will firmly oppose the government's anti-boycott, divestment and sanctions bill, a disgraceful attack on our freedom to fight for human rights, justice and peace throughout the world." Over 60 civil society organisations, including Greenpeace UK and Liberty, have warned in a letter that the bill represents an attack on freedom of expression in Britain. They said, if passed, this law will stifle a wide range of campaigns concerned with the arms race. The website of Press TV has also covered the same story and tells us more. Ben Jamal, the director of the London-based Palestine Solidarity Campaign, has already said that with support growing around the world for boycotts, divestment and sanctions, the British government seems determined to shield the Israeli regime and companies involved in its occupation from accountability for its violations of human rights and international laws. Ruth Ehrlich, head of policy and campaign at Liberty, said, "The proposed anti-boycott bill once again shows that the British government's flimsy commitment to protecting freedom of expression." Ruth Ehrlich said, "The considering the bill by the government is in fact attempting to curb our rights to protect and for people to stand up to what they believe in. She added, "The bill sets an extremely dangerous precedent and its potential impact is harmful and wide-ranging. We urge the government to rethink its plans." Rani Ahmadi, legal advisor to the United Nations at the European Union, who previously served as the United Nations legal advocacy representing BADEEL, the Resource Centre for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights, said, "British government's move to table a bill in the parliament that intends to ban local public bodies from joining the popular boycott campaign against the Israeli regime threatens to erode democratic values, restrict freedom of expression, and undermine campaigns for social justice in Britain." The Ramallah West Bank-born activist and attorney remarked, "We, the Palestinian lawyers, activists from all over the world and civil society, are deeply concerned by the government's anti-boycott bill, which threatens to erode local democracy, restrict freedom of expression under Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and undermine campaigns for social and climate justice."
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of The Last Savior. In this program, we provide you with insights about the Imam of our time so that we may not be among the ignorant, because as our Prophet, peace be upon him, says that the one who does not have the knowledge about the Imam of his time will die the death of an ignorant. Again, we have had the pleasure to be with Dr. Murtaza Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Dr. Karimi, we have discussed what is going to happen before the heavenly call. And now I want you to discuss some of the events that are going to happen after we hear this heavenly call. Do we have some narrations supporting that?
The most important event after the heavenly call is that people will see Imam Mahdi alayhi salam after this heavenly call and not before it. But then there is a question here because, as I mentioned, the narrations related to heavenly call talk about the fact that it will happen during the month of Ramadan. But then, according to some narrations, the uprising of the Imam will happen on the 10th day of Muharram. So now the question is that there are a gap of some month between the heavenly call in the month of Ramadan and the 10th of Muharram. So how we can explain these narrations? One point is that when it comes to the time for the reappearance of the Imam and the date of his uprising, which can be two different dates, we have different narrations. According to one group of the narrations, the uprising of the Imam will happen on the 10th of Muharram. There are different narrations in this regard. People can refer to Kamaluddin, Volume 2, page 561, Al-Irshad by Sheikh Mufid, Volume 2, page 379, Kashf al-Ghumma, Volume 2, page 534, Ithbat al-Huda, Volume 3, page 57. For example, in one narration, the Imam says, يَخْرُجُ الْقَائِمْ يَوْمَ السَّبْتِ يَوْمَ عَاشُورَ يَوْمُ الَّذِي قُتِلَ فِيهِ الْحُسَيْنِ. The day of the uprising of the Imam is Saturday, on the day of Ashura. And this is another point. When it comes to the date, whether it is Friday or Saturday, we have two groups of the narrations. Maybe we'll discuss that later.
Right.
But according to this narration, it will be the day for the uprising of the Imam, for his Qiyam, for his Khuruj, is the day of Ashura, the day when Imam Hussein alayhi salam was martyred.
Right.
In another narration, the Imam says, the heavenly call will happen on the 23rd of the holy month of Ramadan, but وَيَقُومُ فِي يَوْمِ عَاشُورَ. His Qiyam, his uprising, is on the 10th of Muharram, the day of Ashura.
Right.
His name is called out on the 23rd of the month of Ramadan, the night before it, but his uprising is on the day of Ashura. And the last narration that I would like to share is reads كَأَنِّي بِالْقَائِمْ يَوْمَ عَاشُورَ. The Imam says that it is as if I'm seeing the Imam, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, on the day of Ashura. He's standing between Rukn and Maqam around the Kaaba, and in front of him is Jibreel. So these narrations talked about the fact that we have two separate dates. The heavenly call will happen during the month of Ramadan, and the uprising of the Imam is on the 10th of Muharram, the day of Ashura.
Right. Well, let's keep that discussion over here, and we'll move ahead in this very interesting discussion, discussing more about the events that are happening after the heavenly call, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. Shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. We are with Dr. Karimi, and we have had this pleasure to be with him today to discuss more on heavenly call, a certain sign of reappearance, in very detail. Dr. Karimi, you're telling us what are the events that are going to take place after this heavenly call.
Yeah, so the question was that, is the time for the heavenly call exactly as the time for the uprising of the Imam? As I mentioned, the first group of narrations say that, no, there is a difference. The heavenly call will be during the month of Ramadan, and the Qiyam of the Imam, his uprising, will be on the 10th of Muharram, the day of
right.
Ashura. But according to another group of the narrations, they say that these two will happen together. I mean, the heavenly call, and right after that, the uprising of the Imam. There are some narrations. Again, just let me share some addresses. Al-Ikhtisas, page 208. Bahar al-Anwar, volume 52, page 304. Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 262. And Kamaluddin by Sheikh Saduq, volume 1, page 603. For example, in one narration we read, when it is time for the uprising of the Imam, a caller will call out from the heaven, which means that it will happen at the same time. There would be two calls before the uprising of the Imam. One of them is from the heaven. So wait for that call in the month of Ramadan, and then the uprising of the Imam. Another narration, there would be a call from the heaven, and the content of the call, according to this narration, we'll talk about the content later in details, is that al-haq ma'a Ali wa shi'atih. The truth is with Imam Ali alayhi salam and his followers. فَعِنْدَ ذَلِكَ خُرُوجُ قَائِمَنَا. At that time, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will begin his uprising.
So
we have these narrations referring to the fact that these two will happen at the same time. Also, some narrations refer to the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will be seen by the people after the heavenly call.
All right. We should not confuse here ourselves. Like, if we are hearing the call and then we are not seeing the Imam, we are saying the call will be in the month of Ramadan and uprising will be in the on the day of Ashura. And in between, there is some reappearance happening. And we should not be confusing reappearance
exactly.
with the uprising.
And this is one of the ways for explaining these narrations that
right.
Maybe this narration refer to the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will be seen after the heavenly call, but his uprising will be after some month.
Right.
So, according to one narration, the Imam says that Imam Mahdi is not going to be seen until the heavenly call will happen. Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 144, hadith number 3. And we have the famous narration of Ali ibn Muhammad Samari, the last special deputy of the Imam. We know that when he was about to die, Imam sent him a letter and addressing him, he said that you're the last special deputy of mine and there is no special deputy after you. Some people after you will come to claim that they have kind of a special relation to me, that they can see me whenever they want. أَلَا فَمَنِ ادَّعَ الْمُشَاهَدَةَ قَبْلِ خُرُوجِ السُّفْيَانِ وَالسَّيْحَةَ فَهُوَ كَاذِبٌ مُفْتَرٌ. Whoever claims that he has seen me before the uprising of Sufyani and the heavenly cry, he is
a liar.
Not a liar.
Yeah.
So
right.
this narration is also referring to the fact that after the heavenly cry, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam can be seen by the people.
Right. Well, let's discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. We are with Dr. Karimi talking more about the certain sign of reappearance, that is heavenly call. And we're discussing heavenly call in very details. One of the beautiful things that Dr. Karimi mentioned before going to the break, that one of the beautiful events that's going to take place after this heavenly call is that we will be able to see Imam. And may Allah bless our eyes with that tawfiq that we see Imam. Yes, Dr. Karimi.
So far, I mentioned different groups of the narrations, which some people may think that they are contradicting each other, because according to some narrations, the heavenly cry will happen during the month of Ramadan, and the uprising of the Imam is
On the day of Ashura.
Day of Ashura. And according to some narrations, they will happen at the same time.
Right.
Now, there are two ways for explaining these narrations. One is that, as I mentioned before and also referred to it, the heavenly cry will happen in the month of Ramadan and Imam will reappear and people can see him from that time. But then Imam will begin his preparation
for
the army.
The journey of his collecting his soldiers.
Exactly. So he's in need of some time. And after about maybe 3 months in the month of Muharram, in the 10th of Muharram, he will begin his uprising. So there is no contradiction between the narrations. So the narrations talking about the fact that he will be seen, they are also referring to the truth. Because right after the heavenly cry, people can see the Imam. Imam
right.
will reappear. But does it mean that this is the exact time for his uprising? No. After some month, Imam will begin his uprising. The second possibility is that, as I mentioned before, there are some narrations which refer to the fact that the heavenly cry will happen twice. One of them can be in the month of Ramadan, and the second on the 10th of Muharram, on the day of Ashura. So, and this also solved that problem, that issue of contradiction between the narrations. So there is a possibility that after the first heavenly call, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear in the month of Ramadan. And after he prepared his army, on the 10th of Muharram, there would be another call, another heavenly call, to announce the uprising of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and may Allah hasten his
reappearance.
So these are two possibilities, and both of them can be accepted, although the first one can be more justified. And the last point is that, as I mentioned, the heavenly call will happen in the month of Ramadan, and the uprising of the Imam in the 10th of Muharram, the day of Ashura. So the gap between the two is around 3 months and 17 days. Now, some people have asked this question that, is it possible for it to be 1 year and 3 months and 17 days or more than 1 year? Because the narration,
nice question, yeah.
Yeah, the narration says that heavenly call will happen during the month of Ramadan and the uprising in the month of Muharram.
Right.
In the month of Muharram. It can be the Muharram of 2 years later or 3 years later or 10 years later. The answer to this question is that no, based on the narrations which talk about the fact that there shouldn't be a very long gap between the call and the uprising of the Imam. This Muharram is referring to the first Muharram after that month
of Ramadan. So there's not going to be much.
It would be only distance. 3 months and 17 days after the heavenly call. It will happen on the 23rd of Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
3 months and 17 days later, on the 10th of Muharram, inshallah, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will begin his uprising. And may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala include us among the soldiers of the Imam in his army.
Inshallah. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. You can go to the tab COI Call of Islam and find an archive of all our programs there, in case you want to listen to our previous programs. And yes, do listen to them. And you can also find some small clips on the social media platforms by just typing Call of Islam Radio. Well, until another session, take good care of yourself, and wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's foreign minister says that he had a frank, fruitful dialogue with the Saudi crown prince as Tehran and Riyadh have agreed on security and development in all in the region. Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements have condemned latest Israeli violence against Palestinian prisoners, saying that it will not go unanswered. And people in Bahrain demonstrate in support of prisoners who are on a hunger strike, protesting humane conditions at the country's prisons. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has met with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the city of Jeddah. Amir Abdollahian says talks were